Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. How well do you think you know yourself? You might be surprised, or not, by the results from a new app designed to define your personality based on everything you've ever posted on Facebook. Joining us now, the co-founder and CEO of Five Labs, that's the Berkeley, California startup behind the new app, Nikita Beyer. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on.
This isn't how, the app isn't about how you view yourself, but rather how others might view you based on your Facebook posts, right?
Yeah, that's right. We were interested in seeing if people were living two identities, if they were trying to construct different perceptions of themselves online. And also we were interested in seeing how commercial entities might understand us, how they might glean information about our personalities from our wall posts.
Do you, when you talk about how people might be creating new identities on online identities, do you necessarily think that they're doing it consciously?
No, I think that because of the format of Facebook, the way that we have to sort of broadcast to essentially our entire social graph, that we sometimes center ourselves or sort of soften our messages so that it appeals to sort of broad audiences.
So how does the application work?
So you come to labs.five.com and you log in with your Facebook account. We don't store any of your data after your visualization is created. And what we do is we look at the language content of your Facebook posts. And we use a model designed at the University of Pennsylvania. They designed a method and that was published this past September. That was based on the largest language study in history. And we're looking for groups of words or phrases that demonstrate certain personality attributes like extroversion or neuroticism. And then we produce this easy-to-understand visualization that you can compare yourself with to your friends, also with public figures.
And when you're talking about groups of words or phrases, would that include words or phrases that are in things that I repost or things that I like and that kind of a thing, or only my personal posts?
We're looking only at the language of your posts. We don't really look at things that you like, but primarily the linguistic content of text-based posts.
And you broke it down into, what is it, five general groups?
That's right. It's the big five personality attributes. It's the most commonly used sort of personality taxonomy in academia and business.
And I know one of them is openness, because that's what I was.
Yeah, that's right. Openness, some of the words that we found that demonstrated openness were like universe, art, poetry, dreams. Those are the types of words that we found with people that had high openness.
And what about neuroticism? Where did what denotes that?
Usually, some type of anxiety in your speech, using sort of profanity, will often increase your neuroticism score. A lot of people have sort of been concerned about that, but I'm not sure it's necessarily a bad thing. It's just part of who we are, and sometimes a little bit of anxiety can produce very successful people. For instance, Bill Gates on our app actually had a very high neuroticism score.
That's not so bad. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Nikita Beyer, the co-founder and CEO of Five Labs. That's the Berkeley, California startup behind this new app. What's the new app called?
It's called Five Labs.
Okay, so it's called the name of the company. Okay.
Oh, the name of the company is Five.com.
Five.com. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Okay. And a lot of complaints have been raised against Facebook for enabling people to create these false cyber personalities or identities. Were any of the users of your application shocked by their results? Did you get anyone responding with a, you know, hey, that's not me? I didn't feel that way, but did you get a lot of that?
Yeah, we got plenty of emails from all over the world. Some people were shocked that the Facebook API, which is the protocol that we get this data from, allowed you to look at your friends' personalities as well. But this is all allowed through the current policies provided by Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And now it does let you compare yourself with others. That's kind of interesting, too. It shows people that have very similar rates.
Very similar what?
Well, I call it rates, but people who fall very similarly to you in those categories.
Yeah, so you can actually find out which of your friends you're most similar to in terms of your language. And that's been probably one of the more interesting features that people have sort of dug into.
What have they found?
One of the things that I found was that many of my class presidents from high school and college were actually very similar to Barack Obama. So that was an interesting insight that I didn't think would show up.
So you can look at how others are rating in this, how others are falling into this, what category they fall into as well?
Exactly, yeah. So when you first log in, we'll take a look at your Facebook posts, and then we'll also take a look at your friends' Facebook posts, and then produce personality reports for everyone you know, as well as yourself.
And how are you able to get access to those?
So there's a permission on Facebook that allows you to get access to your own posts and as well as your friends'. It's been allowed for several years now, and this was one of the most interesting applications that leverages that possibility.
Have you heard anything from Facebook about this? Are they okay with you doing this?
We had some. They had expressed some concerns to us. They emailed us about ways that we were allowing profiles to be visible. We've since resolved most of those, and it's been going well.
Is there a Five Labs social networking site in the works by way of this personality breakdown?
Yeah. So one of the things that we kind of discovered was that people weren't really being themselves online. And we attribute that to the fact that they always feel like they're broadcasting to everyone they know. They always feel that commercial entities are trying to extract hidden data from their content. So we wanted to build something where people could interact more comfortably, sort of like a dinner table conversation. And that's what we're building right now at 5.com. It'll be released in the coming months for iPhone, actually.
And how will it be different? What will it look like?
Well, we don't want to get too much into specifics as we are in the midst of product development. Mm-hmm. But one thing is that it won't be recorded. And you'll always know who's listening. That's the part of the problem that we saw with engaging on Facebook was when you post something, you don't actually know who's listening. Mm-hmm. You do know that anyone can access that information, but you don't know who's actually going to read it.
And will there be that advertising, the commercial component to it? You have to make money, right?
We actually haven't thought about that yet. Our main focus right now is trying to build a great experience for our users, and I think there's a number of ways that we can become a sustainable business without necessarily extracting data from our users and targeting ads to them.
Have you actually seen a trajectory? In other words, hypothetically, could the personality that you've come up with for me today be different than maybe the one that you might have come up with the first year I was on Facebook, 7 years ago?
Yeah, so personalities aren't necessarily a static thing. One thing that we've seen with Five Labs over the course of developing it is that my own personality has changed depending on which wall post it takes a look at. So I think depending on certain life events or emotional states, we can see your personality fluctuate really over time.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Nikita Beyer, for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. You can check out the website at labs.5.com.
All right. We'll have the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Nikita Beyer is the co-founder and CEO of Five Labs. That's, or I'm sorry, 5.com. That's the Berkeley, California startup behind the new app Five Labs. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Scientists and politicians, including President Barack Obama, have called for an increase in science, technology, engineering, and math education, otherwise known as STEM. That is what is needed, they say, to prepare workers for the jobs of the future, which will include a familiarity and comfort with writing computer code. Joining us now is Mother Jones, editor and author of a recent article about the imperative of computer coding in the STEM curriculum, Tasneem Raja. Welcome.
Hi.
So why do we need to know about coding now? Why can't it just continue to be a specialized field for the rest of us?
Sure. Well, you know, it kind of depends on who you're talking to. So, you know, for people who are already out of school, you know, already have jobs, you're looking for a job, learning code is probably a good idea. You might be interested in it yourself. It may help you get your next job, might help you get a new kind of career going, but it's not necessary. You know, there's been so much talk about, does everybody need to learn to code? Well, I'm here to say that, no, you probably don't. But in terms of our kids, in terms of the next generation coming up, we're already seeing signs that code is no longer just something that you do if you're working, you know, at a startup in Silicon Valley. Hospitals, architects, artists, you know, biologists, code is leaking into so many different kinds of fields that it's really important to start thinking of it more like the way we talk about reading and writing. It's the kind of communication skill that you can use in a number of different contexts than something, you know, that just geeks do sitting in the basement.
Can you describe to me what coding is exactly now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, in my piece, I make an analogy to cooking, and I found that that's been a really helpful way for explaining to people what code is, because, you know, most of us have some familiarity in the kitchen, right? So the way I explain it is, if you've ever improvised dinner, you know, if you've ever had to kind of look around your kitchen and say, oh man, I've got a bunch of random ingredients here and I could either order takeout or I could try to do something with what I've got, that's actually a lot more like computational thinking, which is the sort of brain activity behind code than you might think. Because essentially what code is it's looking around and saying, I've got a problem. What are the ingredients that I'm going to need to solve that problem? And then how do I put them together? You know, how do I kind of arrange these things in a chain of events, if you will, so that I can get to my desired goal, which, you know, in cooking is going to be a dish, right? But in coding is going to be an algorithm that's going to help you solve whatever the problem is that's in front of you.
So to be code literate is not only knowing how to put something together yourself, but how to read someone else's recipe or how to deconstruct someone's dish.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, not even necessarily needing to be able to read their actual code, mm-hmm. but more being able to talk to them in terms of the way that computers think and what computers are able to do. So right now, you know, there's probably a lot of parents out there who think, well, my kid has got a computer lab at their school, and, you know, they do all of their homework on the computer, you know, digital book reports and so on. So they're probably learning what they need to learn, right, to be ready for, like, the 21st century. That's probably not true, because right now what we teach isn't computing. We teach kids how to use computers and how to play with computers. But that's really different from being able to understand what's going on under the hood. And code literate doesn't necessarily mean that you're the person that sits down to write the program, but it does mean that you, again, understand computational thinking. You understand how to look at the world in terms of problems that a machine could solve and the steps and ingredients and time it would take for a machine to solve it.
You wrote about a program called Code for America. It puts coders in city halls across and designers in city halls across the country for a year. Tell us what they do and what the goal is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Code for America has been around for several years now. And one of the projects of theirs, I think, is a really good example of who they are and what they do, is a project called Adopt a Hydrant. So they sent some coders and designers to Boston to work with people in City Hall there. And essentially, they show up in these cities after getting a little bit of training for a few months. And their job is to collaborate with the people, you know, who are already working in city government, you know, who are open to using new technology and new technology tools, but don't necessarily know how to do it themselves. And what happened soon after the Code for America team landed in Boston was there was actually a major snowstorm, and they were supposed to get working on a new website for the education department, but that wasn't going to happen. I mean, they were snowed in. And so they're helping out with the Emergency Response Center, and they're just seeing that, you know, there's a lot going on. Everybody's overworked. And one of the problems that they're hearing about is, you know, it's in a snowstorm, one of the problems is that hydrants get covered with snow, right? So fire hydrants get covered, and then the fire department has a really hard time responding to emergency calls. So it came up that there's actually a list of addresses maintained by the city of all of the hydrants. There were about 13,000 of them. And so in conversation between the Code for America team and some of the people they were, you know, connected with there at City Hall, they started working on an app that basically helps residents, you know, people on the street, volunteer to, quote unquote, adopt a hydrant by using this app and pledge to keep it snow free every time there's a snowstorm. So it's really simple. You know, it's basically just every time it snows, I'm going to go out and clear the sidewalk on my corner. And it's such a little thing. And actually, the code behind it is really very simple. But this is where that computational thinking that I've been talking about comes into play. It's looking at the world in terms of, oh, here's a database of addresses, and here's a real world problem. And there's probably volunteers out there who would do this themselves if they knew where to go. How do we tie all of these things together?
Yeah, it's kind of cool. In Honolulu, it's adopt a siren to check for dead batteries and tsunami sirens across the city. And I love it. In Oakland, it's adopt a drain.
Yeah, because that's one of the ways that this program works. So another principle of computational thinking is called abstraction. And it's the idea that if you make something, make it in a way so that other people can reuse and copy it really easily. So you kind of write with this idea of, you know, you build in instructions, you make it so that it's not too narrow and specific for just your little problem, but, you know, somebody else could turn it into something new. So dozens of cities have adopted adopt a hydrant. They're actually, you know, either using it for hydrants, or they've, you know, what you might have heard this term, open sourced it, right?
Yeah.
So, because it's open source technology, it's written so that Oakland, Seattle, Honolulu can take it and tweak a few things and turn it into something new.
That's a sort of new way of thinking about data and public data that we haven't done before.
Mm-hmm, yeah. You know, when we talk about data, there's been so much conversation, right, about big data and what is it? Mm-hmm. And we think of it in terms of, oh, okay, well, Google and, you know, Instagram and Facebook, they're all collecting information about us, and they're storing it in data centers, and they're selling it to advertisers. And that's kind of, and that's definitely true. That is happening. But that's a really limited way of thinking about data and the power that it has. So one of the, you know, another principle of computational thinking is kind of thinking about everything as data, you know, so this list of hydrants, the people who living in a city who might potentially be volunteers, you know, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, how do we take, you know, pile A plus pile B and put them together? And to do that, we have to kind of expand our notion of what data is. You know, words are data. A list of receipts is data. The number of steps you take to get to work is data, you know? So, like, how can we start playing with some of this stuff?
How sophisticated do you have to be, though, to do something like that? It sounds fun and easy when I talk to you, but, you know, you wrote that most cities will never get the kind of, well, Code for America team, and they can't afford to keep those kind of programmers on the job for that matter. So how do we, is this where the rubber meets the road? This is where the shortage is the problem.
Yeah, you know, we've got to take the long view on this. Like I said, we don't all need to get out there and learn to code tomorrow. We should be thinking about this in terms of, you know, our kids are really going to be coming up in a time where the opportunities for this stuff are just, I mean, it's only going to keep going up and up. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm really a fan of this curriculum called Exploring Computer Science, which is being developed out of UCLA. And they're trying to create a curriculum for code instruction in the classroom, starting, you know, as early as, you know, in Britain and a couple other countries. I mean, they're starting to do this stuff as early as kindergarten and first grade. This curriculum is being developed with, you know, K through 12 in mind. Mm-hmm. And right now it's being piloted in a few high schools in LA. And the idea is, how do we use the public school system to really get this stuff out there, you know, at scale? The way that when, you know, in the 18th century, we as a nation really decided to start taking seriously the issue of, you know, written literacy, reading literacy, and it became kind of a civic and moral imperative, you know, to give every kid the opportunity to learn this stuff. Exploring Computer Science is, out of all of the curriculums I looked at closely, I think the best at a couple things, not just introducing computer science through this idea of computational thinking instead of just, you know, it's all about code, mm-hmm. but also doing it in a way that has been shown to increase the number of girls and students of color who both sign up for and stick with these classes. And a lot of that has to do with the approach that they're taking, where it's about, you know, the why and the how before they, or the, you know, the why and what this stuff is for before they teach you the how of how to actually sit down and code it.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Tasneem Raja. She's the Mother Jones editor and author of a recent article about the imperative of computer coding in the STEM curriculum. If you have a question or comment, if there's some teachers out there that teach computer science at the grade school or high school level, give us a call and tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right, Tasneem, the idea of being a computer scientist sounds to a lot of people really dry and sort of geeky and that kind of a thing. And we know that it's really, really not, but there hasn't been much effort by the educational systems to change that. And it's kind of shocking when that we're turning out fewer computer science majors than we did in the 1980s. Something's gone wrong.
Definitely. Yeah, if you look at the numbers, it's kind of stunning. I mean, we haven't seen the same decreases in other STEM fields. Computer science is the only field that has actually, the only science, you know, field out of science, technology, engineering, and math that has actually lost students signing up for these classes in the last 20 years. So, you know, there's a number of reasons for this. I think one of the biggest ones is the way that we currently teach this stuff. So AP Computer Science is the most widely used curriculum that's available to teachers today. And in my piece, I say that, you know, to continue the cooking metaphor, teaching somebody AP Computer Science means that you're starting them out with Java, which is a programming language. And starting out with Java is sort of like teaching someone to cook by sitting down and saying, okay, let's disassemble a KitchenAid blender. And, you know, that person's going to be sitting there saying, why, what am I going to be doing with this blender? What's it for? When do I use it? Mm-hmm. So Java is a very powerful, heavy tool, but understanding the ins and outs of Java doesn't mean you understand what computer science is for. So I think we've turned off a lot of students because the way that we teach them is assuming that they already get all of that stuff. you know, that they've already figured out for themselves what's so powerful and interesting and exciting about computer science. And we know that culturally, there are a lot of different factors for this, but white boys and Asian boys are much more likely to pick this stuff up by themselves and explore it on their own time than they are other kinds of kids. So, you know, that's strike one right there. There's a number of other reasons, you know, just to quickly mention, it's very difficult for teachers to get certified to teach computer science.
Mm-hmm.
Most high schools don't currently allow students to take these classes for credit for graduation requirements, which, you know, just seems pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So, you know, again, I think people who are interested in looking for some solutions should check out Exploring Computer Science. You can find it by Googling it. And it's starting to spread out of L.A. Chicago and D.C. schools have started to pick up this curriculum. And, you know, parents and educators who want to help change the direction this is going, you know, I recommend you check out this site.
Is this the kind of thing that somebody could approach? Maybe they weren't lucky enough to have anything in grade school or high school. Can they start to explore this in college if they haven't decided what they want to do?
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a number of ways to do that. There's plenty of online tutorials out there that you could follow, you know, if just Google, you know, learning programming or something like that. But fortunately, there are more and more sort of groups and organizations that are starting up to help people do this in a more organized way, because we all know it's pretty hard to learn something on your own time, even if you're in college. And so, you know, for instance, for women who are interested in learning about programming, check out a group called Girl Develop It. That's, you know, it's really open to anybody, but it's kind of aimed at, you know, creating a place where women feel comfortable, you know, asking really basic questions about programming and getting to collaborate with, you know, with peers who are kind of at their level.
Well,
so, you know, that's one example.
Let's talk about girls and children of color. Why mm-hmm. is it that they're not getting into this at the same rates as white males?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is pretty simple. It's social and it's cultural, you know? I mean, like, look at the messages that are out there about who a computer scientist is and what they look like and who's a coder and who's a programmer. You know, what comes to mind? What comes to mind is, like, a young white or Asian male hunched over a computer, you know, all by themselves, sitting in a basement or something, right? I mean, these are stereotypes, and these are stereotypes that are unfair to white and Asian males who are interested in programming too, quite frankly. But this is our kind of dominant cultural narrative around what coding is and who does it. So, you know, that's certainly one factor. Research shows that girls tend to start pulling away from STEM fields in general around middle school. Before then, girls and boys are participating in these classes at the same rate and showing interest in continuing these classes at the same rate. And then around middle school, you know, something kicks in and girls just start pulling away, pretending they don't know, you know, not raising their hands in class, shying away from it. And I think that that's also, you know, that's also kind of a social and a cultural message that they're getting, you know, that girls aren't supposed to be smart, girls aren't supposed to be quote-unquote geeky. So we've got to start attacking this stuff at the level of culture, which is very difficult, which is why a curriculum like Exploring Computer Science, again, is great, because the researchers behind it actually started by writing a book that they spent researching for 3 years in public schools in LA, where they went into the classroom and they up close observed some of these dynamics at play. So, you know, what happens to girls and kids of color who are, you know, very much the minority in these classes? Just what are sort of the social dynamics at play that, you know, most parents and teachers aren't even going to notice? And so then they built their curriculum around what they observed.
Is coding a sort of a language, like a foreign language, that they say for lots of people, if they were immersed in it, if they were learned it at a younger age, it would come to them more easily?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. you know, it's just like anything. The earlier you pick it up, the better. And certainly with languages, this is true. And there is evidence that exposing kids to computer science at an earlier age will, you know, is much more likely to get them to stick with it, including girls. Girls who are exposed at a much earlier age, at an earlier age, are much more likely to end up majoring in computer science in college. So, you know, breaking it down for kids when they're still kind of open to, you know, this new way of looking at the world, this new way of looking at problems, is not just going to be good for them in terms of, oh, they'll be good for coding, but really, you know, these are logic exercises. I mean, this is analytical thinking. So it's going to be teaching you about problem solving and deductive reasoning and all that good stuff. And as a bonus, you know, you'll also probably, if you want to, get to learn to code.
One more question. Is the idea of collaboration. Computer science or coding isn't often seen as a collaborative effort, but from a lot of the way you've talked today, they wrote a book. There's a lot of they involved in this. It's not an isolated one-person job, I gather.
Oh, yeah, definitely not. Again, I think this is kind of a social misconception that people have. So one of my favorite examples is a project by a couple of English PhD students where they, you know, they wanted to explore the works of Agatha Christie. So what they did was, you know, the famous British mystery writer. So they took her entire oeuvre, her entire, you know, work, and funneled it all into a software program which does natural language processing. So it read every word she'd ever written in any of her books. I mean, you know, she had well over 100. And they then started analyzing it in a number of different ways. One of the things that they noticed was that her vocabulary greatly decreased over the course of her life. So earlier in her books, she's using lots and lots of different words. Later in her life, she's using very few unique words, just kind of the same words over and over. Mm-hmm. They took that stuff to some brain researchers and said, you know, just do you see anything here? And in working with the brain researchers, they came up with a hypothesis that nobody's ever put forward about the writer Agatha Christie, which is that she developed Alzheimer's later in life. And so I think for a lot of kids, you know, who've never considered this stuff, I think hearing a story like this, which is coding is not just for Silicon Valley startup people. Coding is for English researchers and for brain researchers and so on. And this is, you know, what a cool collaboration that went on here. I think that would be really appealing.
Well, it is to me. Tasneem Raja, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
Tasneem Raja is the Mother Jones editor and author of a recent article about the imperative of computer coding in the STEM curriculum. More Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holly of Geek.com. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Amazon has introduced its new smartphone, the Amazon Fire. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So the phone has, the new Amazon Fire has a dynamic perspective 3D screen. Do we need special glasses? What is that?
No, so this is really kind of hard to explain. It is a regular screen like you would have on every other smartphone that you would pick up. It's not like a weird glasses 3D or like the Nintendo 3DS where it kind of has a little toggle that gives you auto stereoscopic 3D. This is a regular LCD display that uses four different cameras on the front of the phone to kind of map the perspective that you're holding the phone and uses that to present information. So for example, if you're looking at maybe a panoramic image of you know, any kind of monument or something like that, and you turn the phone, the image itself will actually, the phone will move the phone to a different part of the image. So it looks as though it's moving in a three-dimensional perspective, but what it's really doing is just changing that image to match the amount of motion that you've put into the phone. It's really complicated to explain. It certainly looks three-dimensional, but it's actually not using anything more than kind of camera tricks and a normal LCD display, which is kind of a good thing.
Is this are these images? This is something you'd be looking at as you would be looking using the camera part of the phone, or would this be any image on the phone?
To start off, Amazon has set it up so that the lock screen and a couple of key Amazon apps that can display these images are using the technology, but they've opened up APIs so that developers can do a little more with them later on. But if you were to go and buy the phone today, that it would just be, you know, kind of a lock screen. They have some very big images that they took for the lock screen of the phone so that when you go to unlock the phone, you've got this really neat view as you move the phone around. And things like their map application uses the same technology so that you can move the phone around and it will actually show you a three-dimensional motion perspective shift of the map that you're looking at.
The current smartphone market is dominated by Samsung and Apple. What does the Amazon Fire have that they don't, or is it marketing to someone altogether different anyway?
Well, the biggest advantage that Amazon has over really any retailer is Amazon.com.
Of course.
There are tons of people that go to Amazon every single day. It is an intensely popular website. And if you go to the homepage of Amazon.com right now, the very first thing you see at the dead center of the screen, in three different places on the screen, in fact, are advertisements for the Fire Phone and how you can get it and how it has this dynamic perspective. So it's something that, you know, Amazon may not have the resources that Apple or Samsung has when it comes to being able to push out their own unique operating system or, you know, focus on those kind of things. But they have, you know, what is basically the single largest retail platform in the world.
And how will it work with Amazon Prime and other Amazon services and apps?
So what Amazon has basically done is created a phone that makes it incredibly easy to buy things from Amazon. it's very, very cool how they've done some of these things. But when you kind of sit back and look at it from a high level, they basically built a phone that makes it so that you could be a better Amazon shopper, which is a little alarming on a different level. They, you know, all of Amazon services are deeply integrated into the operating system, so you can do things like you know, listen to Amazon music service or watch streaming video, and things like that work very well. The same technology that's used in Amazon's Fire TV box, where it preloads videos that it thinks you're going to watch, so that when you go to press play, it just starts playing instantly. That kind of technology is built into the Fire Phone as well. And then they have a specific application, a new application called Fireflies. And Fireflies is kind of like a scanner that uses your camera to just kind of observe the world around you. So you take your phone and you open up Fireflies and you point it at a box of cereal, not necessarily a barcode, just a box of cereal. Mm-hmm. And the Fire Phone will recognize that product and show you where you can purchase it on Amazon or add it to a list that you can go back and look at later. And this service works for hundreds of thousands of products that are in the Amazon store. But beyond that, you could point it at business cards or store signs or things like that, and it will grab things like phone numbers and text and save them to your phone for later on. So it's not just for Amazon's services. It ends up being kind of a photo version of Siri, where it grabs that information and saves it for later use.
What are some of the hardware specs that come with this that people should look for?
This is very competitive with what we're seeing with common Android phones right now. It's a 4.7-inch display with a quad-core processor and a 13-megapixel camera. So as far as performance goes, it's going to run all the same applications that, you know, say Samsung Galaxy S5 or an HTC One M8 would run. With no problem. It's not going to access Google's Play Store for applications. It's going to access Amazon's Android App Store which they've had for years now for their Kindle Fire tablets.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have as many apps as Google Play Store, and it doesn't have things like Gmail or Google Hangouts or Google Plus. Google's core apps are missing from the phone. But otherwise, it's very much an Android phone.
Can it compete with Apple and Samsung?
I think that it offers something really compelling if you are an Amazon user for a good majority of the things that you're doing. But I think that Apple and Google both have spent a lot of time making simple things really efficient. You know, things like the dialer and virtual assistants and things like that. And those are things that, because this is the first time they've released a phone, Amazon is very new at doing. So I think that as far as, you know, making a smart device that allows you to play games and read books and do things like that, that it's going to be an excellent device. But it may not be the best way to put that. It may not be the best for doing, you know, things that a phone should do, like making phone calls and storing contacts and, you know, kind of managing your digital existence.
Okay. So if you're an Amazon addict and buy everything by way of Amazon, it makes sense, of course, then that is also your their prime target anyway, right?
Exactly.
Let's.
And it comes with a year of Amazon Prime when you pick one up through AT&T.
Okay. Okay. And Amazon Prime is the free delivery, all kinds of perks by joining.
Absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right.
It's a huge Amazon service.
Let's turn to Chrome or Kick with Chrome or Chrome Kicks. I guess it's called Kick with Chrome, Google's latest Chrome experiment. First of all, tell us what Google Chrome experiments are.
So Google has dedicated an entire team of people to taking the web browser and making it do just kind of crazy things that we don't think about web browsers being capable of doing. They've worked with some incredible people in the past, like Cirque du Soleil and a couple of musicians, to create these visually stunning pieces of art, really, in many cases. But they've also done a lot of things as far as video games go, and just kind of demonstrating how interactive browsers can be in just this really kind of abstract way, because you view it and it looks like a game that would be normally running on the phone, but in fact, it's running in a web browser and it can run on any version of the Chrome web browser. And this is the latest version of that, kind of in preparation for and to keep people interested in the World Cup.
So how is it different from previous Chrome experiments? Is it, what's the diff?
So this is three different soccer-focused games that you can play using the browser, and some of them are, you know, kicking the ball to keep the ball in air. You have like a foot and you use your finger to flick to keep the ball in air. Some of them are scoring applications. And the whole idea is that it syncs with your phone so that you can compete with your friends. But it also allows you to project what you're doing onto another desktop browser. So, for example, you can end up using your phone as kind of the controller, and then the game would play on maybe your laptop. In such a way that it was as though they were connected, when it's really just a wireless network that they're using to bounce off of one another.
You said in your blog post about Kick with Chrome that it taps into pop culture and the crazy competitive nature that follows World Cup fever. Do you think that Google Chrome experiments, that's Google's way to respond and create apps to events in pop culture?
I think that Google has a long-standing history of using pop culture to, launch new technology initiatives to show how these kind of things can happen. The YouTube, for example, does this a ton of the time, where they work with, pop culture icons to accomplish new pieces of technology as they go to roll them out. And I think that this just, using soccer in this way just makes sure that more people are going to go and try it out. And it's an experience that can only be used on Chrome because of the way Google has, kind of worked with this technology. So in a way, it shows this cool thing that you can do with soccer, but it also makes sure that as many people as possible have Google Chrome installed on all of their devices.
And are getting familiar with it.
Exactly.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell about technology, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Get the call in quickly if you do have a question, and we'll try to get to you and get it answered. Let's talk about the another Google story. Rumors of wearable technology seem to be recirculating about Mac and PC worlds. Do you think we can expect wearable Android technology?
Oh, absolutely. It's already been announced. There's a technology called Android Wear.
Okay.
And it's going to be basically smartwatches that are running the Android platform that are designed to work with, you know, your phone. And ideally, it would be any phone, you know, Android phone or iPhone, to give you kind of glance down notifications and access to Google Now for you know, kind of real-time driving instructions and things like that. And I think that the first of those devices is going to be officially announced at Google's developer conference tomorrow.
Google I/O 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what else is going to be happening there?
Well, this is Google's annual event where they kind of say, this is the stuff that we've been working on so far, and this is what we're going to continue doing for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And Android has had a really big focus, you know, for pretty obvious reasons. It is the most popular of the mobile operating systems right now. But I think that we're going to see more of Android on things like our wrists and on our televisions. We've seen Google's Chromecast service over the past year do really well, and I think it's going to grow into a separate Android TV service where we can stream, you know, things from the Google's music store and movie store, as well as access things like Netflix. You know, so it's going to be just kind of the evolutionary step in the Android platform. I think is going to be a big part of what happens tomorrow.
Okay, so Google and Amazon, can it come up with a TV system that could compete with, say, Amazon TV?
Well, Chromecast already does, you know, it does them differently, but it does a lot of the very same things that Amazon's Fire TV does,
mm-hmm.
and it does them for significantly cheaper. Chromecast is only $35, where Amazon's Fire TV is $100. What Amazon's device can do that Google's cannot is play games, access things like email, and those kind of functions. And I think that that is more the direction that we will see Google take tomorrow, is, you know, allowing people to have this kind of universal box that does all of their Android things.
What about Google Glasses?
I want to say that Google's going to go on stage tomorrow and say really cool things about this wearable technology that I really like, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think that Google Glass just became available in the UK, so I think it's really unlikely for them to turn around 48 hours later and say, by the way, we have all of this new stuff when they're just now handing it out to people in other countries in the world. So I think that it's going to be a while before we hear more about Google Glass.
They expanded, though, didn't they, who was getting it in the United States?
Well, anyone can get it now,
right?
If you want to participate in the Explorer program. But it's not like a finished product. It's not like a phone that you would go into Best Buy and buy. It definitely still breaks from time to time, or overheats, or, you know, does kind of crazy things. Because it's still kind of an experiment. But it's something that, you know, was recently expanded to the U.S. and is now available in the U.K. And I suspect by the end of the week will be available in other countries as well.
Yeah, I was just kind of hoping they'd been learning more about it and had something to report.
I would love for them to come on stage tomorrow and say anything about the direction that they want this to head. But I have not heard anything yet. So I'm hoping, but not expecting.
So what are you looking forward to that you expect?
I think that the smartwatch design that they're going to do is going to be very interesting. I think that it's going to pull a lot from the Google Now service, which I really like. And if you're using an Android phone, you should definitely give Google Now a try, which I think most phones can do just by swiping up from the bottom of the screen. But it's going to take that technology and move it to an interface that doesn't require, you know, unlocking your phone and specifically going to it every time you want to look at it, which I think is going to make it more useful.
Okay. I just want to give a shout out to our listeners at the Marion Correctional Institution. Thanks a lot for listening and for being such great fans of particularly Russell Holley. Russell Holley, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, he's a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to All Sides today. And the All Sides credit goes to the All Sides staff as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannan, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.